This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9. I'm Sherrod Kutin. With me, Kusu Chua.
Good morning.
It's good morning. It's a Thursday. I'm very excited about the possibilities that Thursdays bring, as you know. Thursdays.
What do Thursdays bring, Sherrod?
Thursdays, I mean, if you think about it, it's just that point in the week. It gets so exciting because you're on the brink of concluding business for the week. But you're also on the brink.
Business does never conclude. Business always goes on. It's 24-7.
Well, that may be. But for us salaried workers, business might in fact end on a Saturday. So on a Friday. And I mean, it's gone to the days where people actually had 5.5-day weeks. And bank workers still have 5.5-day weeks?
Yeah, some people still have 5.5-day weeks.
Well, amazing. You know, for us who are moving into the future, steadily, goose-stepping our way into it. Okay, quick catch-up on what's happening to the planet. Greenland, big peat forest fires there. Unusual, in fact, quite rare, because 80% of the land of this island is covered by ice up to 3 kilometers thick in some places. Now, what scientists are saying is that these peat fires, probably due to global warming, where the ice sheet has thinned to such an extent that it exposed the underlying peat, and that's caught fire.
Oh, okay.
So no good, because one thinks of Greenland as one of those really cold places. They shouldn't be burning up. So quick check there on the state of the planet. Remember, tell your politicians and leaders that you care about the planet and you want Malaysia to do something. In fact, I think Malaysia is very good about climate change. The only problem is that we're in terms of pushing for a global compact, Malaysia leads the conversation.
It says a lot of things. I mean, but I'm not sure we really push through on those initiatives.
We do. We had on the grill.
We clear land for property development. We don't do too much on the haze. The haze is a transnational problem. Emissions.
The transnational problem. And we've done actually quite a bit to kind of expedite the situation in Indonesia. In fact, we don't expect a haze this year.
We don't expect a haze this year.
We don't expect
that. Well, that's good
news. Yeah, absolutely.
It's around about this time of year usually.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, if you're a parent and your kid says to you, I want to be a DJ when I grow up, what do you say to them? But before you say
it, a lawyer.
Well, Calvin Harris has been named the highest earning DJ on planet Earth. He earned 208 million ringgit in the last 12 months. 208 million ringgit, or $48.5 million. The 10th DJ.
According to which list?
This is a list that comes out.
DJ Magazine.
It was on the BBC. Okay. I can show it to you right now. It's legit. I don't even believe anything else. So it's legit. Calvin Harris there. The 10th person on the list, right, the bottom of the list, earned $19 million.
Who was the 10th guy on the list? Was it Carl Cox or something?
Do you know DJs?
Of course I know
Zed.
DJs.
Zed.
I don't know Zed.
So Calvin Harris, Tiso, The Chainsmokers, Cyril X, Diplo. Oh, my God, they have silly names. Marshmallow. Now, if you're a parent, would you want your child named Marshmallow professionally? Would you want that to happen? But you know what? Just take a pause. He earned $21 million in the last 12 months.
It's big business.
It is big business. We'll be back after this. This is Cream, Born Under a Bad Sign, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Cream, Born Under a Bad Sign. That's Kusu Chuang in a nutshell. He's giggling there.
Great sign, Scorpio, by the way.
I'm Capricorn. I don't believe in this stuff. Zodiac sign. Okay. Oh, voodoo to me. Okay, not to downgrade somebody else's belief system, but, you know, voodoo. I know, but I'm using it in the non-anthropological sense. You know, kind of like the voodoo just means like.
Does everything sound intelligent to you, Sherrod?
It has to. It has to. I'm sure I'd cut in. Okay, China and the study of Chinese history. Chuang, did you do history at school?
I did, actually, and I must confess, it was actually modern European history. So I know much more about Europe than I do about China, which is a bit sad because I was ultimately back from there.
Did you do A-level history?
Actually, but in Australia. In modern European history in Australia.
I studied in Singapore and I did A-level history. We did the 19th century and the early 20th century China.
Really? I did the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution and all about
that's fascinating.
The Bolsheviks and the Lenins and the Stalins.
Well, I did the Opium Wars.
Did you?
I did the Boxer Rebellion. I did the May 4th Revolution.
So to what extent do you think the history books accurately depict what really happened in those countries? Because history books are history books, and they're just written by people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And governments.
But they're written by different people who look at multiple sources, and like any good investigator, you'll have enough people, independent of each other, when they explore history, will be able to correct perceptions, maybe even there might even be some facts that are missing or not available at the time that a history is written. But history as an enterprise has integrity. And I think when you look...
History as an enterprise has integrity?
Of course, yeah. That, you know, so if you were trying
so
to
you
cast...
must explain it because...
Because what you're trying to do is to cast aspersions...
No, I'm not.
Yes, of course you were.
No, because,
cast,
you see,
history is written by individuals and they could be wrong. And so, you know, and I think that's that is kind of flawed thinking. I really believe that history is enterprise.
No, but I studied history. I studied classics and I studied, you know, people like Chaucer. I did Chaucer.
Yeah, I did Chaucer too.
Really?
This is going to be one of those, you know... Okay.
It's only by knowing what happened in the past you can better behave in the future.
Absolutely. And so Jean-Pierre Lemann argues that. So see, this is
see,
your
you
classical education.
You can know Emmanuel Macron, but you can't do Jean.
I was not looking. Argues that China's centrality in the 21st century, and we know it's a rising power, makes it imperative for us as outsiders to understand China a lot better. And I think that with everything, the issue is how we frame history. A lot of young people think, oh, history is boring. They don't like it.
I love history. It was one of my favorite subjects.
Because they think it's about facts. They think they have to, memorize facts.
Yeah, but these fascinating characters from the past, they just did humongously heroic things.
And that is I think that's what history is about.
Yeah.
It's about those amazing stories and the ways in which to frame those stories, right? So how you understand the actions of people, how you understand what motivated them is really the stuff of history.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, now that you know, Chuang, that China is a rising power, because in your day, it was so long ago, you were going to school, China was behind a bamboo curtain. Are you going to do something about it then?
Through the years, I've read different books and stuff. Like, Martin Jacques, for example.
Okay, When China Rules the World.
When China Rules the World.
We interviewed him. We'd had him on the grill.
That's right.
Several times, actually, and twice, I believe. He said the title was, the title, he didn't actually mean literally that China would rule the world, but he was trying to make an argument that it would be very significant.
Every year it becomes even more and more accurate.
Yeah, but so I
certainly from a Malaysian perspective.
Okay, maybe you're too old to pick up a history book and study again.
What
about your children? Are you going to help your children understand China?
They are in Chinese school, so.
And so what are they
by
taught?
By osmosis, they are, the Chinese culture is seeping to their pores as we speak.
So when they go to Chinese school and part of the curriculum, do you look at the curriculum? I mean, are you able to read the Chinese character? Are you yourself literate in Chinese?
No. I wish I was, but I'm not, which is why they're in Chinese school.
All right. And so what are they being taught about China?
Well, I see the books and all that. It's not really...
You read the pictures, do you?
I see the papers and I see the textbooks. And the culture is part of the school. It is inbuilt into the system. You don't necessarily... So you get it anyway. By osmosis, you get it as a student.
You know how politicized history is? In India today, they're taking out, Mughal rule or diminishing Mughal rule Indian textbooks. You know why? Because Mughal rule. Because they're
so
the
you
Muslim
said
rulers.
I cast aspersions on history when, in fact, what I was trying to
no,
say...
No, I was talking about the politicians are taking out bits of history because it doesn't appeal to their sense of how to narrate the story of India. So because you have this Hindu chauvinist regime and they want to push a Hindu agenda...
Point, right, because at the start, at the outside of this conversation...
We're not talking about... Because these are not historians. These are the people who write the history books, who are bureaucrats under the thumb of politicians.
Who
very different from historians.
Who do you think mandates the writing of textbooks in schools.
Politicians.
Yeah.
So it's not about historians, but you cast aspersions on historians. And I want to take it. And I will provide you the recording so you know what you said.
I know what I said, Sean.
Yeah, see, because I'm a bit of a historian myself.
I know you are.
Okay, this is The Clash. Rock the Casbah after these messages. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Rock the Casbah by The Clash. I'm sure it couldn't be Kusu Chung. And the morning run continues. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 6. It is the 10th of August. If you want to join this conversation, anything we're talking about, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. So tell us, the last question we talked about was the importance of Chinese history, you know, in the age of a rising China. I think that, of course, is something that we all kind of come to individually. But Chuang, you were saying your kids go to Chinese school and do, in fact, get a healthy dose of Chinese history.
Well, not really in the sense of history, but really because of the culture within the school. And it's a very Chinese culture, very routine, very regimented, very well organized, high focus on mathematics and science. Great emphasis on things like martial arts, for example.
What about the teaching of English?
Well, it's another subject, but it's not overt, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, the future is China's, some people say. Now, the future also might be those FANG companies, the Facebooks, the Alphabets, the
Netflix, Google,
and all the world. And Google, recently, of course, courting a bit of controversy because there was an anonymous letter that went viral about Google's corporate culture. Anonymous until recently because they have actually identified the employee who wrote the controversial memo, who was opposed to diversity programs and hiring practices within Google. And that person has been fired. So to add fire to fuel to the fire, as it were, of controversy, Google has done what perhaps you wouldn't want to do if you are such a champion of diversity, is to fire somebody who has a different opinion. Do you think it's Google kind of is another misstep for Google to fire this person for expressing his opinion?
Yeah, for sure. But you know how yesterday we were talking about dual class shares, right, Sharad? And about how, you know, these founder, owner-led type companies allow that latitude because investors should, you know, give way to the owner knows best thing, right?
Like but, their vision.
Yeah, their vision,
energy,
the drive, the charisma, whatever. But this has unwanted side benefits. For example, this, because, you know, like within the Uber culture and how Travis Kalanick was ousted from his investors because of all these practices he put in place within the firm. Very similar things, gender diversity, speaking out, you know, there's a certain performance culture there which grated with investors. And I think as you become bigger, there's expectations on how you run your business. I mean, for example, when I was working in Malaysia and when I went to the UK to work for Reuters, I was told basically to, you know, there's a lot of cultural things that you should adhere to. For example, in terms of how you address your female colleagues, but how you address your, you know.
You seem to learn nothing from that.
I didn't want to go that far, but you
yes.
You know what I mean, right? Yeah. And there's certain social mores that you should adhere to, but you know, within these type companies.
Okay, but if you're a company, right, and you're leading Google, and a dissenting memo comes out. So this is a memo. This is an opinion that's contrary to corporate culture. Corporate culture extols the virtues of diversity. Da, da, da. This person comes out and says,
"That's what the textbook says."
That's right. And then this person comes out and says, "Well, actually, it's not quite what it seems to be, and it's really quite bad in some ways for people with minority views." And then what you do is you say, "Ah, who's this person who wrote it? And I'm going to fire them." Proving the point that your commitment to diversity really doesn't extend to diversity of opinion in a genuine sense.
You see, but the thing is, it's happened before. I mean, remember Greg Smith, the former Goldman Sachs employee? He was told to leave because, you know, he went public to the Wall Street Journal about how the culture within Goldman's was obviously detrimental to clients. And then remember in fiction as well, Hollywood, Tom Cruise in Jerry Maguire, for example, he had an epiphany at 4 o'clock in the morning and he went public to the whole office and he was basically told to leave. And the only
but is
person,
that a good move? If you were leading Google, would you do that?
But there's pros and cons, you see, because you want the chip to move in one direction, and then you've got this one-to-way refute. Well,
but do you want groupthink? I mean, I think that's the problem, right?
Yeah.
So if the dissenting views are a minority view, then do you want to actually get rid of the minorities? They pose no threat to you. They don't. They pose no threat to the corporate consensus.
Well, you see, what we have right now is his point of view, his sole point of view. You haven't seen anything from Google yet, so
this Google's expressed its point of view by firing him.
Yeah, but what's the official line? Maybe there's something more to the storyline.
Maybe there was. Maybe there is. This is Morrissey. The More You Ignore Me. BFM 89.9. That was Aerosmith and Run DMC with Walk This Way. I'm Sharad Kutan, and walking with me this morning, Kusu Chuang. It's 40 minutes past 6 on the 10th of August. You like that little intro, didn't you?
Actually, that's a bit of a crutch, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. In the break between the bulletin and that song, Chuang, you actually did a little search for the man in the limelight.
James Damore.
Yeah, the man who got fired from Google. And we were talking about whether this is fair or not. And he was interviewed by somebody on...
Toronto University professor, James Peterson or something.
James Peterson, right. And so quite a fascinating thing because, you know, it's a very kind of low-octane interview, but... What the interviewer does is sort of appeal, you know, ask all the basic questions like, you know, were you in trouble? Why were you hired? How's your performance been since you were there? And try to lay the groundwork for the moment, I guess, where he writes that memo and then gets fired. And we hadn't reached that point in the video. But I think if you look up
James Peterson,
Yeah. And the man from Google, a very young man with a huge nose.
James.
Yeah, because he looks like he looks like a muskrat. Okay, now also in the news yesterday, of course, was the Inland Revenue Board's raid on the office of Mokhzani Mahathir, son of Pakatan Harapan chairman and former Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir Mohamad. Also in the news yesterday was the raid by the FBI on one of those close associates of Donald Trump, Paul Manafort, and a real kind of like a Washington, D.C. move and shaker insider type, fix-it man. So lots of happening around the world, including now dispute over the Kenyan elections, where the incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta is leading and his rival Raila Odinga is saying that... The voting machines were hacked, and this has been denied by the Elections Commission. So lots of drama all around the world. Malaysia is no exception to that. Now, a country where there is often very little drama, though we had recent the Lee family feud, is Singapore, which is a country with apparently one of the lowest crime rates in the world. And a 60-year-old man recently was under investigation for inserting toothpicks into a seat on a public bus. The man was arrested for mischief, and he could be facing a 2-year sentence. And so that's led to some speculation about what happens in a country or in a context where crime is so low that even the smallest misdemeanors now seem so much greater. So we have in our front pages this morning the terrible case of a father who raped his daughter, and there's over 600 charges against him, right? So separate incidents. That's huge. Putting a toothpick in a bus, on a seat on a bus, is that major? And would it get you 2 years? Should it get you 2 years?
You know what I thought of? Because I clicked through to the Guardian story, right? And there's a picture from one of the tweeters. And basically what this person did, you know how toothpicks are quite sharp? So he actually... poke them through the seats of the train seat so that whoever sits in it will obviously get a bit of a pain. But it seems like the person who this is a little bit mentally unstable. He's a 60-year-old Chinese Singaporean male, I presume. So why does he do this? You know, if you do pranks, you're someone who's in your teens or in your early 20s, why does a 60-year-old man do this? So maybe he's a little bit mentally unstable.
Right.
How did he get to the States, right? So maybe it's the Singaporean system which made him a little bit unstable in the first place. Maybe. Right?
But that being what it is, the question is that on the scale of things,
it's nothing, la.
So if he's facing a 2-year situation, is it because you are in a situation where there is so little compare? So you don't have those major crimes, seemingly, and so something small gets sort
blown
of
out of proportion.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that could happen? Could you see a situation where people are near perfect, as Singaporeans might be, and then even the smallest thing becomes an issue?
So yeah, you know how in university you're supposed to write essays and you're supposed to compare and contrast and discuss, right? Mm. So you have a Singaporean situation where there's no crime or virtually zero crime, and then you got Malaysia where the biggest crimes go unpunished, right? So which one is the greater good or the worst evil?
I think, though, it must be said that people do get caught in this country, not always in a timely fashion, but yes, justice is sometimes served. We'll wait and see. This is Aretha Franklin, Chain of Fools, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Kusu Chuang. That was Aretha Franklin with Chain of Fools, and we are no fools. And
well,
I can say that proud
you and me.
And with assuredness. Okay. Well, the Education Minister, Dato' Sri Mazuin Khalid, announced recently that students in our 10,000 schools, our public schools, will be allowed to bring certain mobile devices to class. And this is because I think the recognition that, those devices can be educational, they be used as educational tools. The question is, is this a good move? And we spoke to Datin Noor Azima. She's the chairperson of the Parent Action Group for Education in Malaysia, PAGE. We asked if she thinks that schools and teachers are anywhere ready for this move.
Yeah, so there are countries that have successfully done it. But again, right, you need a whole policy and you need to have teachers who understand it. You know, they understand the issues with cybersecurity. They understand the challenges with opening up sort of Pandora's box. Because right now, you know, how is a teacher going to manage the usage? How are you going to block sites? So I think, based on my experience, there are still many, many teachers that do not know how to harness the power of technology, now let alone regulate it or manage it in a classroom. So, you know, I've yet to see what the plan is. I mean, I read the article in the newspaper, but what is the plan on managing and regulating it within the classroom? I think that's the big question. That's why, again, for me, I believe that the way it should be is, I mean, we're a rich enough economy. We're an amazing country. We as a country should be providing computers and proper stable internet connections to the school and then going and using them within the school, not having people have to externally create the digital divide, create social divides, and then you create this whole big regulation challenge. I mean, can you imagine, right? Teachers are already bogged down with KPIs, with all the things. Teachers everywhere, I think they have a lot of work to do. Now you tell them, hey, here's a whole new world which you have no idea about because you're not a millennial, and some of you probably don't even know how to use a computer, but now you have to manage young people who are really smart at computers, really smart at apps, and you manage that and regulate that. Good luck.
That was not Noor Azima, chairperson of the Parent Action Group for Education. That was, in fact, Raj Rinvan Singh, founder and CEO of Souls 24/7. Now, the question is, a lot of parents will have an opinion about whether devices are a good idea, but to bring in schools for their kids. I mean, you are a parent, Chuang. I mean, what's your stand on this? I mean, and do you even let your kids have a mobile device?
No, they are only allowed to use mobile devices on the weekend and TV as well. But intrinsically, when you have children and you have school going children, the school bags are full of books and they're extremely heavy. So on that basis alone, if you can digitize the content and put it into a mobile device, then the harm done to small bodies might be obviated. But the thing is, on what content you put on the mobile device. And I think that is the issue, because governments might have to put the entire curriculum into like an app, for example, and ring-fence the content to just that app, because I think that is the issue. when you give them an internet-ready device, the risk and the fear is, I think, they are able to access all kinds of stuff on the internet which might be contrary to what you want to propagate.
Yeah, but what about this, the question of distraction? I mean, to what extent, the mobile devices a distraction?
If there's other stuff like games and, YouTube or whatever.
No, even if it's just other educational stuff. I mean, the thing that you're not focused.
So I think that's what's happening in the US, because if you are given mobile or tablets which only have content which you... which is educational content, then it's
so
okay.
It's just merely an digital platform.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, but this is other thing that I think it's quite fascinating about the way kids read and on mobile devices with hyperlinks and stuff, as opposed to reading a book. And I think there are very strong arguments to be made for reading a book, a traditional book, and from cover to cover, and keeping with the thoughts and ideas and following through with it, as opposed to having something that constantly leads you to another page, another link.
Yeah.
And I think it's really changing the human mind.
Well, the other thing is, we don't really know the full extent of the effects these mobile devices are having on our brains or on our body. I mean, certainly I've spoken to people whose eyesight, people like me, in the 40s, right? People whose eyesight have actually deteriorated quite significantly in the last few years. And now doctors are saying that it's because of reading mobile devices late at night and the artificial light that causes your eyes to deteriorate?
Yeah. Chuang, if you had time, I would suggest a brilliant book by a neuroscientist and child development expert, Marion Wolf. She's got a book called Proust and the Squid, and she talks about how the human human brain has developed with the advent of the written word, and the amazing transformative potential and power of the written word on the human brain. And it's something worth. You can even get it as an audiobook,
Oh, okay.
And so you can listen to it as you drive to work or back from work. So all that is there out there, amazing world of knowledge. And BFM is bringing that to you. It's also bringing to you Crowded House, Something So Strong, BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Kusu Chuang. And the morning run continues. It's coming up to 7 minutes past seven. It's the 10th of August and a Thursday. Warms the cockles of my heart, as it does you, Kusu Chuang.
Yes, it does. Thursday. Thursday's a great day.
Okay. Now, 2 days ago, on Tuesday, Deputy Home Minister Dato Noor Jazlan Mohamed said that there are too many undocumented immigrants have driven Putrajaya to register them using the biometric data system. It's a new one. It's called the Tracking Refugee Information System, or TRIS. We spoke to Adrian Pereira of the North-South Initiative, a human rights organization that focuses on migrant issues. We asked him how big this issue really is.
Actually, in the many cases which we have handled, with regards to migrant workers becoming undocumented, we find that many came in the country with documents. Our estimates, rough estimates, are about 90% and above came in with documents, and through various problems and conditions faced, became undocumented. So, of course, that puts them in a very difficult position. I also have a comment about lumping refugees and migrant, undocumented migrants in the same category, because both are very different issues. Of course, because we didn't sign the refugee convention, then if you're an asylum seeker or a refugee, you almost have the same legal status as an undocumented worker. So it's a bit tough. I was just looking at the article and I'm not sure why they say that there's too many migrants in Malaysia, because the industry keeps saying that they don't have enough workers. So who's really doing the maths, the economic planning of how many migrant workers do we really need?
So we also asked him if he thinks this new system will be beneficial for migrants and refugees in any way, or if it will in fact leave them more vulnerable to exploitation.
From my experience, I think any country has the right to control the border, those who are coming, crossing in and out of the border. But when you say, even the name is called tracking, refugee information system. How is this data going to be used? How safe is it really going to be? Because we need to be aware of data privacy. If this data gets into the wrong hands, for example, if it gets into the hands of a trafficker, you know, they may exploit the situation. And I totally don't agree that such a system to be beneficial for either the country, the migrant workers, or even Malaysia. I mean, you have the right to document, of course, but how is that data going to be managed? And if I'm not mistaken, from a recent Auditor General's report, those who were deported for various violations, I think a big number of them were not flagged. So this raises another question of how efficient. And me and my friends as civil society, we always welcome cooperation with both the Ministry of Home Affairs and also the Human Resource Ministry, because I think this really needs to be addressed to make sure that it's done efficiently, to work out a better formula, a more rights-based formula, and how to manage workers, undocumented workers, and even refugees. Yeah.
We also asked him if this resort to technology would be sufficient, and if there is a more comprehensive way in which we can deal with the question of undocumented workers.
We really don't know how the system works, so it's very hard to comment. But I think if you look at the recent rates, the number of employers that were taken to task is really small compared to the number of employees which were or under so-called undocumented workers who were detained. And it's really not healthy for the country. It's not healthy for the private sector. It's not healthy for migrant workers. So we need to look at a larger picture of finding a solution and not merely, at the border, some registration system, because traffickers and people with bad intentions have defeated the system before. I think there was a case where somebody was switching off and on, the immigration system at the airport. I think there was a bust a few years back. And if you look back at the case of the death camps at the border, Thailand, just few days ago, they charged a police general for the human trafficking. But in Malaysia, we haven't heard much about who has been charged and who has been, how many people were involved. There's not much transparency in that process. So, yeah, I think there's a long way to go. Still very premature to come up with a conclusion.
And that was, I'll just get his name here, Adrian Pereira of the North-South Initiative, a human rights organization that focuses on migrant issues. Chung, I mean, there are a lot of things perhaps in this discussion that we can begin with. I take this whole question of employers, right? And so employers in the Klang Valley, and if you've been to restaurants or whatever, you know that they potentially use people who are undocumented. And there it's a question of cost, isn't it? And so do you think that, in fact, in some ways, that employers are part of the problem? They've created the demand for a way for the undocumented to remain in this country and to actually make it desirable to overstay and work.
No, you're right. But this whole discussion really begs the question of why wasn't registration of migrant workers enforced in the first place? I mean, we are in charge of the borders and the checkpoints. Why didn't we have this?
I think we do have a system, because obviously.
But how is it allowed to balloon to a point? Because I mean, we've talked about how there could be as many as 5 or 6 million foreign workers in this country, half of which are registered and half of which are not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if Malaysia is that huge of a country that we can't at least monitor to some great extent the inflows and outflows.
Yeah, and I recently interviewed the new deputy general of the immigration department, and we talked about to some extent these kinds of issues, and I think there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests that actually the problem lies in enforcement, right? So when somebody is confronted with the fact that they do not have documents, instead of that person being apprehended or brought to the relevant authorities, then it's just an opportunity for some sort of exploitation, extraction of some sort of money. Basically, you're paying somebody 20 ringgit. And yeah. for the very savvy foreign worker, you just cost this in. You cost in bribing officials to stay in the country.
It's
right?
A business. It's a business expense. You can say the same thing about illicit cigarettes, which is a huge problem in this country, or contraband. Malt liquors, for example. These are two very big issues, which go largely. These are offences which are largely uncorrected. At this point in time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking the business side of this, because it does really disturb me. Because I've talked to some workers in, say, this Indian restaurants, right, and they brought it from India. They're actually legal, but the terms on which they work here are horrendous. They get half a day off every 2 weeks, and the hours they work. So this is super exploitation of these workers. And because you could never do that to a Malaysian worker, but you can do it to a foreign worker.
Yeah.
And I think, do you think it's going to kind of like eat at the sinews of our businessmen who found it for so many years so easy to get cheap, pliable, and highly exploitable workforce?
If there's loopholes in the system, then businesses will take advantage of it, right?
Absolutely. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.